Excuse me, the recordings have started.
Okay, thank you. This is Greg Aaron, and this is our Registration Abuse Policy Working Group for December 21st, 2009, our last meeting of the year. And why don't we begin with the roll call. Marika, would you like to do the honors?
Yes, no problem. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, Barry Cobb, Vital Shaw, Greg Aaron, Rod Rasmussen, James Bledel, Philip Corwin, and for staff, we have myself, Marika Konings. We have apologies from Margie Milan, and Gisela Gruber-White will be late.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's hop right into it. Today, if at all possible, we'd like to close out the last remaining abuse topics that are to be discussed, which are stolen or fraudulent credentials, sale of counterfeit goods, false affiliation, and unauthorized use of logo. And we have Martin Sutton joining us now.
Hi, yeah, sorry for my lateness. I'm stuck in the snow.
Okay, thanks, Martin.
Okay.
All right, so Rod, if you would, this is your document that we see up on the screen. Would you like to walk us through? Now, what we did last time is we kind of walked through some of the issues. And you explained the broad strokes, but maybe what we ought to do is concentrate on the latter part of the document, which has some ideas for recommendations for discussion. How does that sound?
Okay.
do whatever you feel you need to do.
All right. Well, we went over this last week. I thought it was fairly long-winded, but I can, as usual. But I can certainly dig in here a bit as well. And we didn't see any discussion on the list, so maybe we can get some of that going, so we can flesh out the actual placeholders that I had at the end here. Just to recap for those who weren't on the call last week, I took the word credentials and broke it down into really what I saw as the three places that could apply to what we're talking about, because credentials themselves, it's a fairly broad topic area when you just look up the definition in the dictionary. So we had I considered kind of three categories in credentials, in use in information technology is, let's see here, we have the access control type of thing, which is username and password and things like that, where you can get on and, you know, use it to get into some sort of system. You had cryptography, which are cryptographic keys, etc. And then you had identification. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the Wikipedia. Here we go. Get my brain working here this morning. I was actually reading the definition from Wikipedia. So the three that I actually came up with are identity credentials, which are, you know, things about a person. This gets into the things that establish a person's identity, whether it's like your passport or your driver's license or things like that, your personal information, your access credentials, which allow you to get into, you know, computer systems and things like that. And then financial credentials, which are credit cards and the like, that allow you access to money. So those are the three types of credentials. And then took a look at the various types of abuses we're seeing against those, and how that applies to domain registrations. And then what we didn't talk much about were, what we can do in the roles for policy and other things that we can talk about as far as mitigating those abuses of those different types of credentials. within the domain registration process. And really, you get into looking at those from a model of how the registry actually works, what they accept as part of the registration process. You look at ways that people can get a hold of their different credentials and then misuse them later on. And then, you know, try and applying that across a band of, or a wide swath of different registration methodologies can be challenging. But I think there certainly are some commonalities, and if nothing else, baselines can be set as far as how, if you are dealing with certain types of credentials, they're dealt with, and best practices as to how to deal with them beyond beyond that. So I have put together kind of at the end of that document a placeholder for looking at models from other industries, whether that's the payment card industry or healthcare or other people who have to deal with personal information credentials, financial credentials, and access credentials. I think there's certainly some room for improvement in all three of those areas, given the widespread use of stolen credentials in the registration process today. And then also what can be done as far as you know, getting best practices and minimum standards for protection for those types of credentials across the industry. And it's going to vary depending on what type of credentials we're talking about there. Access credentials, you know, that's good password management and things like that. Financial credentials, you're looking at adoption of standards that are fairly well publicized. It's a matter of you know, actually doing them for the most part, and you know, requesting, requiring, calling it a best practice, what have you, that people follow those standards. There's standards, and then there's the actual application and enforcement of those standards. And then, you know, for PII type of things, you know, that's something that I think one of the things that we run into is that we're all talking about doing some sort of data sharing between entities within the domain registration community to allow us to track down and prevent bad guys from doing things. That's been talked about in multiple forums. But one of the questions is do our current agreements and policies, et cetera, even allow for that to occur or encourage it to occur? So all these other efforts that are being talked about may run into some difficulties getting implemented if we don't have a framework for which in to work with, you know, data sharing, et cetera, across an industry, because there's always concern about collusion and these other antitrust type of issues when you start talking about data sharing between elements. And I know we've run into that in various groups that are trying to set up data sharing agreements. So can we codify that at some point so we can allow for that? So those are some of the ideas, et cetera, that are in there. I think at this point, you know, I've got some placeholders in there for talking about specific ideas, but I don't have anything concrete. We need to figure out what we want, may or may not want to put into this section and get it written up.
Okay. Thank you, Rod. Thank you very much, and thanks again for writing all of this up. If I can, my suggestion is first, it looks like there are several ideas in here, some of which might be for best practices, some of which might be for policy making. So let's try to figure out if there are any policy issues and then any best practice ideas. So in on that last page, you have several things. Now, which of those would be policy related. Under addressing use of stolen identity credentials, there's an idea to provide a policy framework to allow information sharing between registrars on fraudulent domain registrations and registration attempts. Okay, so let's open that up for discussion. My question is a policy framework within ICANN needed, or is it applicable? I'd like to open that up to the floor. Mikey?
Hi, Greg. This is Mikey. I think the question, and Rod, you're going to probably want to chime in on this. One of the reasons you may need a policy framework is to clarify some of the anti-collusion legal stuff so that information can be shared between business entities in a way that doesn't expose them to the liability that they might otherwise be exposed to in a fair trade sort of context. I know that in the PCI industry, I can't remember if there's law or regulation about this, but it allows otherwise competitors who would be accused of colluding to share certain kinds of information between themselves, I think. And Rod, again, you're way more current and closer on this one, but I think that might be the reason that that's in there.
That would be, that's why it's in there. But I am not a lawyer, nor do I play one on TV, but I do participate at parties. So.
Okay, I see James's hand. If you're done, Mikey.
Yeah, I'm all done.
Okay, over to you, James.
Oh, thanks, Greg. This is James, and apologize if I'm not coming through very clearly, but I think that Mikey raises a good point. You have to ensure that your I's are dotted and T's are crossed relative to making sure that there's no underhanded information sharing or collusion going on. But I think that the one of the best ways to do that is to ensure that you have a third party that is acting as an intermediary to collect and distribute all the data sharing, especially when it's narrowly specific, specified as being information that's relative to fraud or criminal abuse or something like that. I don't know that that means that necessarily ICANN is the only organization that can step in and fill that need. We have a couple of other organizations that could be equally suited to step in and be the centralized trade association or clearinghouse for that type of information. Hello?
Okay.
Oh, okay. I thought I lost you guys.
Okay. Got a couple of hands. Let me go to Barry first because he hasn't spoken yet.
Well, for the moment, I guess I just have a question. When we use the words like a policy framework versus the idea previous where it just talks about the dissemination of best practices, each of them is really talking about the sharing and dissemination of information. So I'm just, my question is what does the policy framework part of this idea make different than just the sharing of best practices? And I guess specifically the question is, does this framework allow for a fast track of new policies to be developed to combat stolen identity credentials, or if I could just get a little clarification there? And or an example of something like that may exist today. Then I can't.
see. Let's go to Rod and then Mikey. I see their hands up.
Okay, this is Rod again. Barry, I think that the idea here, and it actually gets to James's point as well, because there's two back-to-back ideas here within that stolen credentials area. One is this policy framework, and the other is the data clearinghouse. I think those almost have to go hand in hand, in that if you're going to have some party, you know, third party or what have you, you know, that's gathering and sharing this information, that you have to have within the community that's doing that sharing some sort of a framework for how that works and how that, you know, protects and indemnifies the people who are sharing that information. I think that, you know, within the ICANN world, you know, you might want to just take a look at how the whole thing set up in the first place, is that there's access and policy set up so that, you know, people share access to the central root, you know, zone files, to be able to add and enter things in. The registrars all share access to a central registry, for example. I mean, that's taking a kind of a broad stroke, but in order to make sure that there's that people will actually play, and this is what we run into in the abuse world, is people don't want to do things because they don't think they're protected when it comes to information sharing. They would like to, but there's somebody saying, oh no, you can't do that because we don't have the legal authority to do that, or we may potentially somehow expose ourselves to risk. So given that, we don't want to do it. So codifying things in a way that says you're okay to do that from a central resource is usually very helpful in getting people to cooperate that want to cooperate, but they just have some sort of something holding them back from a risk management perspective.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, and then I see Mikey's hand.
Thanks, Greg. This is Mikey. Just to piggyback on what Rod just said, I think the policy framework on information sharing is really just as he described it. It's sort of the rules of the road and who's liable for what and what are the boundaries of what can and cannot be shared. What can we do to indemnify the folks that are sharing the information? And then to James's point, I sort of agree. I don't think that ICANN is probably the right organization to actually host this service, because I think that's pretty far outside of ICANN's mission and charter. But I think that ICANN is a pretty good place to put this policy framework in place and start the conversation between the people that need to participate. You know, I think we're going to run into a really similar discussion in the Root Zone working group that two of us are on. How is this going to work? What are the rules of the road? Who's responsible for what? And I think ICANN is actually a pretty good place to hammer out that understanding. Even though I don't think it's a good place to actually provide the service that may emerge out of that.
Okay, thank you, Mikey. This is Greg. I'd like to share some perspective from the ecosystem out there that kind of deals with these issues. Right now, registries and registrars do share information about malicious uses of domain names with each other. And they do that in some various fora. You know, there are security groups and mailing lists where people are saying, okay, I've got a problem on this domain name. Can the sponsor and registrar take care of it, for example? And then there are groups like RISG, which is a group of registries, registrars, and some security companies who have been working on a data exchange program. again, to point out places where phishing and malware are occurring. Afilias and Internet Identity, GoDaddy, and MarkMonitor, amongst others, are in that group. And they got together not under ICANN auspices, but because they want to share information. I've never had a registrar share credit card information with me in my security work because they say they can't do that for security and confidentiality purposes. What I hear from them is that's just a legal issue. So I'm wondering, there is therefore an indemnification aspect to it, but that would be, I think, between parties, and I don't know if that's an ICANN issue. I rather have my doubts. Now, there are also some third-party organizations out there that facilitate this kind of thing. For instance, there's an organization called Ahsoka, and that's a third party where companies can basically share information and do credit card checking. For example, the registrars who have joined that. And the problem they're trying to solve is that fraudsters are using stolen credit cards to create new domain names to do bad things with. And so I know some registrars have joined that as a way of improving their fraud checking on the cards. So my question personally is this more of an issue between parties? I think there is that indemnification question, but I don't know if that's an issue that should be solved within ICANN. So that's my perspective. Martin's raised his hand.
Thanks, Greg. Just to keep checking here, I mean, we probably head on to specific information when you've thrown in credit cards there. I would say that it doesn't necessarily have to be those particular elements if that's deemed a problem, should it be. But certainly phone numbers, emails, contact information, etc., that regularly appears on Whois could potentially be a useful thing to share. If there are concerns through, say, data protection security issues, if the purpose for the data sharing is to prevent crime, there are a number of areas there that are able to assist that data sharing facilitation, because the purpose is a legitimate purpose. So we probably don't need to at this stage get head up too much on what detail can or cannot be shared. It's what problem are we going to solve? How big is that problem? And what are those data elements that will do the best in terms of combating the fraudulent activities? So just wanted to raise a couple of points there.
I'm sorry, this is Greg. I was on mute. I think Rod's next, and then Mikey.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. This is Rod. I was about to see if you're still around. I wanted to follow up with on Martin's point there. One of the areas we've run into, varying regulations and thoughts of what can and can't be shared is in the area of IP addresses, and very specific stuff that is going on as part of the registration process. Where again, it'd be nice to have some rules of the road, or here's what we know we can do to work some of these practicalities out with on those various efforts that are going on, and the RISG effort and a couple others that are out there. I'm thinking very specifically about how helping
not only just enable those to work, but to help encourage other members of the community who we may not see showing up at some of these meetings to be able to say, oh, we actually have created this ability to share this information and have, you know, through various processes external to ICANN, what have you, have these in place. ICANN, of course, can help codify these things as far as being able to, this is a accepted practice. This is a proper thing to do. Whatever terminology you'd like to use, but it is very helpful in dealing with the registrars who, are a little recalcitrant when it comes to trying to get them to participate in anti-fraud measures. When ICANN does make a pronouncement about something, dealing with that, it's amazing how much more cooperative they are in dealing with issues, rather than just falling back and saying, well, we can't do anything. So that's one of the reasons for actually just putting some things in place. And at this point, we're just talking about ideas here, not actually trying to develop any policy, but what would that look like and how would that be helpful? So I think that's what I'm trying to concentrate on there.
Thank you. Okay, and I think Mikey is next in the queue.
Thanks, Greg. It's Mikey again. I think that the reason that I, at least in this pre-PDP phase, lobby for a policy discussion about this is because I think that it's all the things that we've been talking about. ICANN is the central place where these particular stakeholder groups get together, and it may be a simple matter of the policy group saying, well, this other group is really already doing exactly the right thing, but I doubt it. I think that there's, when it's pairwise kinds of relationships between subgroups of the ICANN constituencies, we run the risk of missing opportunities to broaden the reach of those things, and we also leave people uninformed and unmotivated to participate. So I think I'm continuing to lobby for a recommendation that at least we take a policy look at it. I agree with Rod. I don't think we've got the cycles, the time, or the charter to actually formulate that policy, but I think it's a worthy discussion.
So, Mikey, this is Greg. How would we encapsulate the policy questions that needs to be explored?
I'm going to be a guy and make stuff up, but others feel free to chime in. I think one of the policy discussions is to what extent should participation in these kinds of activities be required of registrars and registries. I think another is what kinds of participation are we expecting, both in terms of the legal relationships and in terms of the technical relationships. I think another policy discussion is the one about collusion and setting up the legal framework to protect the entity's ability to share information without fear of legal repercussion. And I think another is it's probably not necessarily a policy discussion, but a best practices discussion about the preferred form of the entity that the information is shared through. Is it a separate organization from ICANN, like guess would be probably yes. Is it a nonprofit? Is it a for-profit that's jointly owned by registrars and registries and others, et cetera, et cetera? I think that ICANN is a great forum for that kind of discussion, and you know, those four bullets would at least get it kicked off.
Yeah. Thank you, Mikey. And I think that it also raises a charter conundrum for us, because this group has been charged with figuring out whether those things are in scope or out of scope. Would we be kicking the can down the road to say there should be a policy effort to figure out if this is in scope or out of scope for ICANN to do? Mikey?
I think we have to kick this one down the road a little bit given the amount of time we have left. I think we can sharpen the issue and I wouldn't be that uncomfortable putting it forward under the umbrella of saying that it's at least the discussion is in scope for ICANN, even if the outcome of the discussion is no policy for now. But I don't think, given the fact that we need to get a preliminary report out basically within a month, I don't think we can much beyond what we're doing here. Put it on the pile, but not answer the question.
Yeah. Rod, why don't you go next?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I hope that the discussion we're having is you know, would fall within scope, and then we're talking about facilitating data sharing that would be part of the registration process to curtail abuse. So we may have already answered the question of scope or not, but it's a more of an implementation question as to how you would, you know, how and if you need policy, and then how and if, you know, you do various best practices or things like that to facilitate this type of activity. But I think that the idea here is that we've got issues surrounding the registration process itself and policy around data sharing of information and the like. So I think we can hopefully be able to agree that it's we've got something within the scope of what we're talking about, and it's really a matter of what we're saying needs to be looked into further, is in that which coincides with what the rest of the things we're doing, is that we've got questions about, you know, actual how do you do it.
This is Greg. I had raised my hand. I'm speaking, of course, just as an individual member right now, but I'm not sure if this is in scope or not. I don't think we can say that it is in scope. I think that's perhaps an open question for now. Now, Mikey also just raises a practical question, which is, We've got to put our report out in February. Now, our report is going to be an initial report, though. And one of the ideas of initial report is the then get constituencies to comment, and you get comment also from anyone else in the community to then inform a final report. And the final report is what GNSO Council then take the actions on, right? So they're not going to really take any of our recommendations until we've gone through the whole thing. So it sounds like we've got an issue that we're still wrestling with as far as the scope question. It's fair to continue this discussion over the next few months, perhaps. What we could do is say, you know, this is a vector that's being used. It's in the registration process. There are some issues that we haven't come to consensus on yet, at least. And you know, continue it that way. Rod?
I just wanted to try and get an idea of where the group stands on, you know, whether we've got something within scope here or not. And you know, I don't know whether I'm in the majority or the minority, or am seeing something that seems to me so obvious that it's frustrating for me that others don't. So I'm trying to understand what is the question of scope and where the group is. If we're going to spend some time working on this, may as well figure out where we are. So I might want to request that we figure out where we stand and what needs to be done one way or the other to make this either happen or go away.
Very, very fair. Let's figure out how to frame this then, so we can do our hand raising and such. Take a straw poll. We have a couple of ideas before us. One is there something within policy scope? Now, when we're talking about policy scope, we're talking about binding policy. So that is policy that would be required of registries and or registrars. Then there's also, there's another realm of non-binding stuff, and that would include best practices and so forth. Now, so what is the policy issue? Are we saying that policies around the sharing or use of stolen credentials is within ICANN's scope to make binding policy upon? Is that an appropriate way of phrasing the question? Again, that is making binding policy upon the use or sharing of credential information within scope, within ICANN policy scope. Does that sound right, or should we rephrase? Mikey?
I'm not going to come up with rephrasing yet, but I think one of the issues that we're sort of tiptoeing around is sort of a sequence question. In a way, it's hard to know whether ICANN should make a binding policy until we know the sort of practical implementation of the thing that they're going to make policy about. So, for example, it may take an iteration of figuring out how to do the sharing and how to organize it before we can say, this is such a good thing that everybody ought to participate at least at this minimum level. You know, I think I would be nervous about saying participation is required in a policy context before I knew what the thing people were participating in was going to look like. And so I think that perhaps the thing that's in scope for ICANN is in the context of providing leadership on this issue. We have Rod, a fellow who spends his whole life basically in this environment, saying, ICANN, you are the most obvious people to have this conversation and at least take a leadership role in figuring this out. ICANN, you may or may not have to make specific policies, but it's certainly within your scope as an organization to organize this conversation and facilitate it. Now, I'm sort of putting words in Rod's mouth when I do that, but I think that I'm a lot more comfortable with a pretty broad definition of the scope question than a really narrow one.
Right.
It may turn out that the actual legal context of sharing information may be outside of ICANN's scope. But
what I'm hearing from you, Mikey, is that you don't know if it's in ICANN's scope to impose policies here yet.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. So I have doubts as well. I mean, for me, there is the question of ICANN is a good place to discuss these things, but that might end up being best practices. At the same time, my view is we have to ask, is ICANN the right place to make policy on these things? It might be the most obvious place, but it still might not be the best place or the right place. So that's kind of just where I am. All right, so let's get back to the phrasing question. Sounds like we don't know yet, actually. I'm saying I don't know and I have doubts about whether ICANN can make policy in this area. Mikey's expressed that he doesn't know yet, at least. Can we say with any confidence then that this is within scope? And we have to leave it as an open question.
This is Mike speaking without his hand raised. Sorry. If you said that is the question of information sharing between registrars and registries an arena of ICANN, within scope for ICANN policymaking, I would say absolutely yes. Who is the perfect example of information sharing between registrars and registries? We already have lots and lots of policy about that. And so I don't have any doubts on that front. What I'm not quite so comfortable with is the degree to which certain kinds of information sharing would need to be required in policy until the definition of that information sharing was a lot clearer. And that's the sequencing question I've got.
Okay. So how do we move forward? This is an area that needs more exploration. It sounds like we have consensus on that. But we don't know all of the policy implications. There's also the possibility that this kind of stuff might not be a binding policy kind of an issue, but there are all those other possibilities like best practices and so forth. Can we agree? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Berry, I'm sorry, I'm not in front to raise my hand real quick. I'm just curious, hypothetically, let's say we all agreed that there should be policy made around this particular topic and we make a recommendation as a team and move forward with it. What happens if it's not within scope? They would just deny the recommendation and then move forward. So I guess my question is what harm do we have by making a good recommendation that, you know, X number of level of effort needs to be done around this topic and then let the powers, kicking the can down the road, so to speak, and let the powers that be make that determination for us?
I think there are two issues nested in there. You're right. The council will ultimately decide what course it wants to take, to authorize a PDP or an issues report or what have you. I think it's an issue for the individual members of the group to decide whether they want to state that there are policy issues, definitely. I think that's up to each member to decide whether they can take that step. Okay, I see Marika's hand.
Yeah, this is Marika, because just to Barry's point, indeed, you know, if the council would take the recommendation forward and say, well, let's explore what is possible in the policy development process, the first step would be an issues report, which is developed by staff, of which one of the elements is the advice from the general counsel on whether it's in scope or not. And it normally provides some guidance as well, you know, where possible, like which parts might, for example, be suitable for consensus policy development and which areas might not be in scope. So further work would always be done, you know, regardless of the recommendations that, that this group makes on, you know, assessing that against the bylaw requirements.
Okay. Thank you, Marika. Rod, I still see your hand raised. Would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, Greg, thanks. It's Rod. I was going to say, I think that one of the big problems we're running into here is we've got a kind of a high-level concept and a few particular ideas that aren't very well fleshed out as far as addressing things. So it might be good just to put a placeholder in for this at this point, and for perhaps we have a subgroup, which I'll volunteer to be part of, to flesh these out a little bit more, so we could maybe have some more concrete things that get us to a point where people feel more comfortable one way or the other, being able to say, yeah, that belongs, or no, that's really something that, you know, it doesn't belong in our discussion here, as we've done with several other issues. That's just a thought for moving us forward practically here.
Thank you, Rod. That would give us a little more meat to sink our teeth into. I mean, that sounds good to me, if that sounds good to everybody else. Anybody else who would like to help Rod with that?
This is Mikey. I'll join.
It's Martin. I'll join to help thrash out anything there, Rod.
All right, I'll take that as an action item for to be done offline and posted up to the group. I have Rod and Mikey and Martin on tap to do that. Okay, excellent. So thanks in advance for that. If possible, I'd like to then, since we have an action item on that, I would like to move on to the next topic, since we're a little more than halfway through this meeting, if that's okay with everyone. The next item is sale of counterfeit goods. This was a proposed abuse that it was proposed back when we were compiling our initial list. I forget exactly who had proposed it. Does anyone recall? Well, anyway, let's find that on our sheets. Just a second.
Right above false affiliation.
Is it under false affiliation? Okay.
It's just called counterfeit by itself.
There's another one on the very last on page 5, the very top of page 5 in the document. I just found the search function, by the way. It's very cool.
Yeah. So we have counterfeit, which is websites used to sell counterfeit goods, impacted party being consumers. And then did you see another one which applied?
No, that was the one I found.
I think that's it. Okay. So, sale of counterfeit goods on websites. Is this a registration abuse? James has raised his hand, and then Mikey.
Hi, Greg. You anticipated my statement, I think, with your question. I don't believe that this is at all related to the registration process, and this is a use function since it presumes a website. Thanks.
Thank you. Mikey?
This is Mikey. I'd chime in on that. This seems very much like a use question rather than a registration question.
Okay. Martin and then Rod?
Yeah, I'd at this stage say the same thing, although I would like to just question out, and probably James might be able to enlighten us. I saw some recent news articles. GoDaddy did quite a bit of work on this, and there's a specific policy that you've got drafted into your registrant agreement, I think it is, with regards to counterfeit drugs being sold. I mean, again, that's probably content and use rather than registration, but is there anything useful to draw out from that, from what you've experienced so far?
This is James speaking. Respond to Martin. I don't have any first-hand information on that. I'd have to check and see if that's where that's actually been inserted. I'm guessing it would be probably into our universal terms of service for hosting. And it's also something that we've worked with in conjunction with our legislative groups there in Washington, D.C., to get this added into various online criminal statutes. So, of course, that would be U.S. only.
And I suppose the point from that would be, if that's relevant to the registrants of a domain name mustn't use it in a particular way, is there anything that we could draw from that which is relevant to either users' best practice or introduce for all GTLD registrar agreements with registrants?
And again, I'll have to get back to you on that, but right now I'm thinking that that's more targeted to our hosting terms of use rather than our registration terms of use.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
Okay, and I see Phil with a check mark, and then Rod has his hand up.
Yes,
Rod,
thank you. Yeah, thanks, Greg. This is Rod. And James, I think that it also applies to your domain registration side as well. I think that's in response to the illegal pharma stuff, and the I think it's the Ryan Haight Act within the U.S., if I recall correctly, so you might want to check on that part of it as well. And I would say that, yeah, again, we've come to another issue where it looks typically like a use case issue rather than a registration issue. But like many other things, the scale and the methodologies that the people who are doing these kinds of things are using, we've got all kinds of other abuses we've talked about over the months where you've got large, hundreds, thousands of domains being registered on an automated basis, set up a fast flux to support these kinds of activities. Gets the same question, begs the same questions again. Are there things that are being done on such a scale that the registration side of the equation comes into play? As far as the individual abuses go, absolutely, I think it's a use case. It's when it gets to scale and it starts to affect large swaths of the internet and users on the internet that you start looking at, well, gee, is there something we can do on the registration side of this? So I just bring that up because it's yet again another example of what kind of misuse that people are putting the domain name system to in general out there.
Yeah. This is Greg. I'll go, and then Mikey's raised his hand. With these use issues, I don't think scale is a matter. ICANN in general is responsible for the overall health of the DNS, and those activities don't impede the general functioning of the DNS. They're a big problem, and they cause harm to consumers and so forth, but it's not a technical issue.
that is making the DNS break down. So I don't think this. I don't think scale is a consideration. I think it's a domain name use issue. Now, there's absolutely an interesting angle here, I think, for best practices. I think this is an example of something where maybe one or more registrars have put that in their registration of use terms of service because they don't want to be associated with that kind of stuff. And that's kind of a moral stance. It's probably also a business stance because if people are doing that kind of thing, it creates a lot of issues. And you want to you don't want those business issues of having to handle all those abuse complaints and spam complaints and that kind of thing. So I think registries and registrars should be allowed to put things like that in their terms of service, but I'm not sure that ICANN should be able to mandate it because it's a use issue. Mikey, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks, Greg. This is Mikey. I guess I have a question for Rod and maybe you too, Greg, and that is if you could determine the intent to register a domain name to use it in this way, and that's, I think, what I'm hearing and what basically both of you are saying, then all of a sudden my mind changes because if you could determine at registration time that a person is registering a name in order to do counterfeit goods, especially counterfeit pharma, but almost any kind, then all of a sudden I'm quite cheerful saying, sure, this is a registration abuse. Is there any chance that that's possible?
Let's see. I see Rod's hand.
And Mikey, in some cases, yeah, it's a lot like the same people who are doing this are doing malware, doing phishing, doing or the same types of organizations. The same types of setups are being used. At least, you know, in today's world, if you get a string of 1,000 registrations in that all happen to use the same name servers as the ones you killed yesterday that happen to have all been registered typically fraudulently with, you know, stolen credentials and are all pointing to a fake tag Heuer, or however you pronounce it, watch site or what have you. It's the same stuff. It's just a different flavor of the same stuff. And some of it, you know, this is where we kind of run into some interesting dilemmas in that you've got, you know, phishing and malware and things that are illegal everywhere versus this kind of stuff that's not necessarily illegal everywhere, but it's using the same techniques and the same kinds of methodologies for setting them up, oftentimes the same exact infrastructure providers behind them. So, yes, you can determine a lot of it. You can't determine all of it. So, you know, there's always that thorny issue as to, you know, how are you going to make a policy that can capture and encompass everything if you're going to make policy. But yes, certainly you can find a lot of these things. And I would, you know, since we don't have it, I don't think we have it listed. I'd throw fake job sites in here too, for lack of a better place to put it. But those are, you know, you got your pharma stuff, your luxury goods, your software, you know, piracy. So we may have piracy on the list, if I forget. And then, you know, your fake job recruiting sites that are typically turned into money mules and things like that all use the same kinds of techniques, often with FastFlux and the like. So it's all kind of intermingled.
Thank you, Rod. This is Greg. I raised my hand. I agree with Rod that and I'm going to speak as a responder who deals with complaints and sites and domain names that have these kinds of problems with them. Sometimes you can establish to a pretty high degree of certainty, especially when you kind of have a repeat offender who's working on a known infrastructure, or it's, you know, you have a batch of domain names and you're able to see problems associated and prove problems associated with some of those domains, you know, kind of implicates the whole batch, for example. I also agree with Rod that sometimes you cannot determine intent beforehand. And that gets into a really tricky legal area. I think this all comes back to a topic that we've discussed before, which is, are you going to require a contracted party to do something about a domain name that may have the legal activity associated with it? I think I am hearing that everyone thinks it's a use issue, but I think it comes back to these issues of, can you force people to shut down domain names and that kind of thing? And, you know, and we've kind of outlined the indemnification issue that goes along with that. And we'll be putting some material in the initial report about that. I think this, again, this is a kind of illegal activity. It's in that respect, it shares the same issues with malware distribution and phishing and all those other things. I'd like a reaction to that. Anybody? Mikey? And then James.
This is Mikey. I agree. Basically, what there is a huge list of bad things, this being one of them. False affiliation and so on being another. And I'm still comfortable with those being in the use case. The only thing that I'm intrigued with is this notion that if you could determine the intent at registration time to do any one of these bad things, the way we've been just discussing, I'd be okay with putting some policy or best practice tools in place to help registrars and registries combat that behavior. But other than that, I agree this is a use case per se.
Thank you. James?
Hi, Greg. This is James, and I just wanted to kind of chime in on a little bit of a response to what Rod was mentioning. And I keep coming back to this difference between a registrar and a hosting firm, and many registrars are also offer hosting services. But I think that the point I'm trying to make is that the difference between a registrar operation and a hosting operation is the difference between suspicion of intent and evidence of intent. So, you know, you may look at a registration of a domain name and say that looks a little suspicious, but only when someone puts up a website and actually tries to deceptively or illegally solicit a business across that website does the suspicion, you know, become something that can be proven. And I think that one good thought experiment that might be useful in helping us draw these lines between use and registration abuses is that if we were to imagine a registrar that had no web hosting operations and simply just offered the registration of a name, you had to provide your own DNS services and hosting services, and how little discretion they would have in terms of intervening in some of these cases. I think that's a good thought experiment to help us draw the line between registration abuse and use abuse. And when I think about what can possibly result from ICANN policy, that's how I'm picturing the impact on a registrar that has no hosting operation. So I'm on some cold medicine right now. I hope that made sense, but it's the idea that we continue to step over that line somewhat or blur that distinction somewhat freely, but I think that we need to keep that in mind as we discuss these topics.
Okay. Anything else, James?
So I think that's it.
Okay. So I'd like to make a proposal. Is there general agreement that this is mainly a use issue? Can I get a quick pulse check on that? Do you agree it's mainly a use issue? You can use the check mark. If not, use the X. Okay, so got checks from myself, Barry, Faisal, James, Martin, Mikey, Philip. Only one who hasn't voted is Rod.
Put a check down for me. I'm dealing with kids at the moment.
Check. Okay, so there is unanimous consensus. It's really a use issue. I have a proposal. In the report, we've got a number of these kind of bad criminal things, and that takes in this, malware and a couple other things. I would propose that we discuss this topic in that context, because they all share some similar policy issues, and they could also be discussed because they have similarities for best practices. I'm happy to also try to volunteer to draft some of that. We have some material on the wiki about malware and botnets, but we need to write some text about the criminal stuff and what intersections, if any, it has with policy. So I'm happy to volunteer to do that because I've been thinking about the malware a bit. I'm happy to have anybody join me. So we certainly need some material for this stuff in the initial report. So if anybody would like to join me on working on that, please do let me know. See, Mikey?
I didn't mean to do that, but I'll join you. Sorry.
Okay, you're on tap.
I'm not on cold medicine. I got no excuse at all.
Okay, thank you. All right. So I think, unless anybody else has anything else, that covers sale of counterfeit goods. Our last issue is false affiliation and unauthorized use of logo. So on a little spreadsheet, we said false affiliation is a website that is falsely purporting to be an affiliate or brand, and the consumers can be harmed there. Unauthorized or improper use of brand or logo on a website can harm the brand owner. So I guess, again, the first question we always ask is, what are the policy dimensions? Is this a use issue? So open that up for discussion. I think Martin is first, and then Mikey, and then Faisal.
Well, I'm impressed to beat Mikey to the post there, but usage, that's all I say. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm with Martin.
I guess it's my turn?
Yes, Michael's turn.
I think that's right. I think it is usage. I think there's a couple of things, I guess, with false affiliation, that the old, putting trademarks in meta tags and whatnot, I think that's part of it. And then actually usage within the website itself, using the logo and displaying the logo within the actual page. I think both, when you look at both of those, it's probably both usage as opposed to registration.
Okay. And by the way, in these definitions, it doesn't say the brand name and the domain name, because I guess that would be a cyber squatting issue. This is just what's on the website, as far as I understand. Is that everyone's understanding what this is?
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Okay. James is next.
Yeah, Greg, actually, that was exactly what I was going to say. It was the difference between having a distinctive string in the domain name versus having some logos or names on the website. And then that clearly pushes this over to the use side of the fence.
Thanks. This is Greg. I'd also raise my hand. Yeah, it seems to be a use issue, especially since cyber spotting's been discussed. It also seems to me to be a dispute between two parties rather than necessarily a criminal thing. This seems to be more trademark infringement, that kind of thing. So that's, for me, an issue between two parties for them to figure it out. Anyone else have any comments?
Hey, Greg, this is Faisal. Is this something that would go, just taken out completely, or is it go within the cyber squatting category?
I think our cyber squatting definition has to do with what's in the domain name string.
Okay.
Mikey?
Yeah, this is Mikey. I was just going to chime in. This could go in along with all the other criminal stuff, I suppose, but it's in some. I think your point is well taken, Greg, that in many cases this isn't necessarily criminal. It's a civil dispute, a tort, you know. So I don't know. I mean, it could go in that chunk of the report that you and I just volunteered to write as an example, I suppose.
I'm personally thinking, and this is Greg, that it's not a criminal thing, because when you're using somebody else's logo or that kind of stuff, it seems to be a criminal, not a criminal, but a civil thing. It's between the two parties. It's not something that you would ever get your district attorney to draw charges up on.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Martin?
Yeah, I think that's just important to recognize. We've got the important elements of crime, etc., so the phishing, for instance, or the malware, where there may be use of brand in domain names, etc., or within emails, within site content, which takes it to that next level, which is, you know, fraud. This is simple brand issue elements, I think, here, where, you know, you have to observe and respond as you see fit, and that's down to brand owners. There's no loops in here that would be worth pursuing, I don't feel, through any policy or best practice sharing within the sort of ICANN community as a whole. I would suggest that we just mark this as out of scope, you know, looked at on which date, but decided as out of scope.
So Martin's made a proposal to say this one's out of scope. Does everyone agree with that or have a different opinion? You can use your check boxes if you agree with Martin. We have check boxes from Barry, James, Martin, Mikey, Rod, and myself.
I agree as well. Somehow I just got read off, so put me down for it. Yes.
Okay, so we're putting Faisal down for check mark, and the only person who hasn't voted is Phil. But it looks like, absent that, we've got some consensus that it's out of scope. So we'll note such. And that brings us to the end of the proposed abuses. So congratulations. We've had a long list that we've gotten through. We have met our goal for this meeting. So thanks, everyone. We are running a little short on time. We have about 10 minutes left. I'd like to take that time to talk about the path forward. We do still have some work to do on cyber squatting and uniformity of contracts, but we can pick those up next time. Last week, Marika and I were talking about the mechanics of putting an initial report draft together. And Marika, we had all agreed, would be at some point the kind of the keeper of the document. She also knows how to put it into the correct format, which includes standard outline for these GNSO type papers with an executive summary and then discussions of various issues, recommendations, and appendices for additional materials. It also these documents also have line numbers, so as we go through, we can refer each other to line numbers as we're in the editing process. Marika and I had talked, and we were thinking that we were going to take all the material off the wikis, and she's going to start slotting it into a draft document, and we will have a draft to start working from in January. So what this means practically is that we will stop using the wikis for drafting. We're going to take whatever material is there and plop it down in the appropriate spots. Marika is going to try to put material in a proper spot, so she may need to rearrange some material or kind of standardize format a bit for readability, but her goal is always to preserve the intent and any important language, of course. So hopefully around January 4th, which is our next meeting, or shortly thereafter, we'll have a rough draft. It'll be very rough, and there are some spots where we still need to do some work. But at least for the first time, we will kind of have a view of our whole thing. And we're going to need to take January to fill in those spots where we think we still need to do work. So does anybody have any questions about the process that we'll be undertaking in January? Okay. What I envision is there will certainly be spots that we're going to have to call attention to in our January meetings. We're going to have to do some intense editing. Marika will keep the master document, but I am anticipating that a lot of us will need to do markups of various kinds, not only pieces that we still have to write, but also pieces where you suggest changes. By late January, we want to have that draft in much better shape, so that means we will have to do some work offline. And then use the online meetings to work through any language that we feel really needs help. We also have to use some January meetings to figure out kind of where we stand. Do we have or do we have edits? Marika, I see your hand raised. Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to mention that we're in the process of looking at a better online tool that will allow for like live editing of documents as for another working group, but I think it might be helpful as well for this group. So, because in Adobe Connect, you cannot do that. You can show documents and you can write notes, but you can actually not do live editing. So if we have that in place, it might be something that this group might want to make use of as well. So they can collaborate on editing the documents during the meeting.
Okay, thank you. So to look at our timeline that's there on screen, January 4th is hopefully the deadline of any other stuff that we need to write. There's major stuff. We want to try to get it done by then. That'll then give everybody in the group a chance to read it and make edits over the next few weeks. We then have meetings on January 11th, 18th, and 25th. By late January, I'm hoping we have basically a master list in that document of all the recommendations that we might make. Those could be recommendations for all kinds of things. At that point, we may put up a poll using an online polling function and put up recommendations and maybe other sections of text up there. And this would be an opportunity for everybody to weigh in on whether, you know, they're comfortable with those or want to suggest additional changes. It's basically a temperature taking in late January to kind of figure out whether we've got consensus on some things or not, or areas in which we need to have some final discussions and see if we can get to a consensus on various points. Then shortly after that, hopefully we'll have final drafted recommendations, and we will have to then go through another polling process to tally up the levels of support. So in all of these working groups, we have to basically give people a chance to say whether they agree or disagree. If they don't, they can write up a minority opinion, and we can figure out where all the members fall. So it's consensus measuring. Maybe voting isn't always the right term, but that's kind of what it is. We have to attach people's names to those opinions in the initial report and then say whether we've got unanimous consensus or not, et cetera. So then that's got to happen early February, and the draft has to be finalized and posted out to the Secretariat no later than February 12th. And then we go to the IK meeting in Kenya. And then, Marika, I have a question. Once we publish the initial report, when does a public comment period begin? Does it happen then, or do we wait until after the Kenya meeting and the council has had a chance to read the report?
Normally it opens straight away, but as we're meeting in Kenya, and I think there's agreement that, you know, public comment period shouldn't start during an ICANN meeting, I think we could easily start it just after that.
Okay, so do you think the comment period would begin in February or early March after Kenya?
Then probably March after Kenya, unless we already want to start it beforehand and have it out in the public.
Okay, got it. Okay. And how long does the public comment period usually last again? Is it 45 days? Hello? Did we lose Marika, or can anyone else hear me?
Okay.
I'll bet Marika's phone did its hour and a half thing.
Okay.
Dropped her off the call.
Okay. All right. Well, that's okay. We can follow up on that later. So anyway, I have it at 27 after the hour. So that's what we'll be up to in January and February. Today represents kind of a major achievement for us. So I think it's a wonderful way to close out the year. And I'd like to thank everybody for closing out that list. Certainly, everyone have a wonderful holidays. Some of you have already begun your holiday seasons. And really enjoy yourselves and have a great New Year's. We'll pick up in early January.
Thanks, Greg. Great job.
Thanks, Greg. Cheers, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, everybody. Take care.
Take care.